everyone. It's the Life of Gem podcast, audio now, available on all streaming platforms and on Apple Podcasts. Today, to set you in time, is Friday, April 12th. It's about 11:41, and this episode should drop this weekend by no later than next week. And I am so honored today to have an amazing guest, a beautiful writer. She writes in multiple genres, Carla Sammoth. She's a writer, a teacher, a mother. She holds an MFA in creative writing, Latin America, from Queen's University of Charlotte, and a bachelor's degree in Latin American studies from the University of California, Santa Cruz. She also studied economics and literature at the Universidad Autónoma de Mexico City. And as a teacher, she strives to help others tell their stories and hone their craft while experimenting with new forms. Carla is the co-poet laureate of Altadena 2022 to 2024 and a poet laureate fellow with the Academy of American Poets. Her chapbook, What Is Left, was published December 2021 with Dancing Girl Press. Her memoir, which was reissued by Golden Foothills Press in December of 22, is titled Day on the Gold Line. You have to get it. It's amazing. And her most recent full-length poetry collection, Secondary Inspections, was published January 2024 by Nymeria Publishing. Carla's writing on blended, unblended, queer, multiracial, and single-parent families has appeared in a variety of publications. Her work has been selected 3 times as Notable Essays of the Year and Best American Essays. That's a hard thing to do. A Pushcart and Best of the Net nominee, a Pasadena Rose poet, a West Hollywood Pride poet, and a former Penn teaching artist. Carla has taught creative writing to high school and university students, as well as incarcerated youth and other diverse communities. Welcome, Carla. Such an honor to have you.
Thank you, Jem. It's so great to be here with you.
We first met in AWP in Seattle, and we traded memoirs. And I was just blown away by your memoir. I read it like a year ago, and then I recently reread it a couple weeks ago and was amazed again. And then your latest book, Secondary Inspections, I just read straight through twice in the last couple of days, so it's fresh. Do you mind starting with a reading for us?
Sure. Shall I start with One Day on the Gold Line?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about it to the listeners, because I'm going to read from an excerpt from an essay in the middle, towards the end of the book, the title essay, One Day on the Gold Line. It's a memoir and essays. The essays are linked, and it's meant to be read in order. So I was on a lifeboat in the middle of the Mediterranean when I realized that if I were to die, my biggest regret would be never having had a child. My memoir is about my difficult journey to having a son and the myths I believed about how easy it would be to create a family that was a safe sanctuary. I thought that my son having a queer mom, being Black and Jewish, and being part of a blended family, or even with a single mom, would just make life richer for him. But the reality was much harder. And my memoir is about how I navigated life's challenges, including miscarriages, racism, homophobia, identity, and my teenage son's struggle with drugs. It's also about the joy, vulnerability, and intensity inherent in motherhood, starting with the first moment you even consider having a child. So, I'm going to read from One Day on the Gold Line, the essay. I crouched, handcuffed, and in a pool of my own blood, on the Highland Park metro station platform, begging, "Help, someone please," and crying out, "Mommy." Passengers were walking in and out of trains, but making a wide berth, staring, not stopping. I was a 50-year-old Jewish woman, a single mother of a 13-year-old Afro-Jewish son, a writer and the owner of a PR firm in Pasadena. I frequently rode the metro to appointments in the downtown LA area. On that day, December 28th, 2009, I just wanted to go home, have a glass of Chardonnay, and watch Weeds. I was glad the year was almost over, a rough one, that included the unblending of our blended family and the crushing impact of the recession on my previously thriving business. I had left Union Station, boarded the Gold Line, and was gazing out the window when an LA County Sheriff's Department deputy asked me for my ticket. I had not paid attention to the fact that they patrolled the metro, which, as I would learn later, was the responsibility of new deputies who had just finished their stints at the LA County jails. I dug for my Metro Day Pass in the usual chaos of my bag. He barked at me to keep looking, then said, "Give me your driver's license," which I did right away, though I was surprised by the aggressive tone. I found the receipt for the pass that indicated the date and time I had bought it, though not the pass itself. I showed it to the deputy, who gestured impatiently for me to follow him off the train. "That's not good enough. You can show it in court." I was not eager to go to court or pay a fine. "Wait, please don't cite me. I can find the pass. I know I have it." "You'll have a much worse day if you don't get off right now," he shouted, and I got right off. As I exited, I heard the crackle of a two-way radio. I knelt to look for my pass, but a female deputy ordered, "Get up. Put your hands there." Sheriff's Department deputies immediately surrounded me, brown uniforms looming over me, blocking the view of the 4 p.m. rush of passengers. Swirling around the station. "What, are you going to search me?" The words flew out before I could think, but I immediately put my arms on the pillar. I was on automatic. Everything happened quickly and felt surreal. She searched me, shoving her hands roughly around my body, over my breasts, around my waist, and down beneath my underwear. I had never been patted down before, other than at the airport, and never this aggressively. Instinctively, I reacted to her hands jerking around my body, poking, grabbing. "Stop, you're hurting me," I said, and pulled to the side. Within a second, she bounced my head, slam, 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 against the pillar, simultaneously snapping handcuffs behind my back. I both heard and felt a loud crunch, the impact of bone hitting a hard surface. For a moment, I genuinely thought I was just having a bad dream. One of the deputies whistled and said, "Oh dear, looks like she broke one." I saw bright red blood spurting out everywhere. My nose, mouth, ears, I wasn't really sure where all the pain and blood were coming from. I thought of myself as a strong woman, but at this point, I was broken. My earring had fallen to the ground and was floating in my blood. The deputies stood around chatting, ignoring me even when I begged, "Please help, let me call someone." And I hurt so bad, everything hurts. I squatted, dripping blood and mucus. I could not fathom how I had ended up where I was and felt as if I was in some kind of alternative universe, one that I cried out to be released from. Another asked, "Did you call?" And the response, "Must be a busy day for the paramedics." "We told you to keep your head back. You can't use a phone until the supervisor gets here," they shouted at me, annoyed at my cries for help. I tried to lean back, but choked on the blood. I fell backward, twisted up with the handcuffs. The tight metal dug into my wrists. The female deputy remained impassive, silent, even when I asked her, "Why did you hurt me?" None of the deputies moved to help me. They continued to talk among themselves. I heard one belch. I began to feel an odd sense of disassociation. Trains rattled by in both directions. People walked by me, staring ahead and avoiding my eyes. There was a general din around me and a thick, clogged feeling in my nose and ears. I tasted metal. I felt dizzy. A supervisor arrived with a video camera. For a moment, I hoped he was someone who would make sense of the nightmare, but as he interrogated me, it was clear he was not the one. He started out asking me, "Ma'am, are you hurt?" "Yes, I hurt all over," I said, as I sat on a gurney provided by the paramedics who had also arrived. Blood covered my nose and upper lip, as well as the metro platform where I'd crouched. He proceeded to ask where I hurt. When I began to respond, he cut me off with, "Can you tell me what happened?" In front of the woman who broke my nose, he questioned me. "So then what did you do?" "Well, two paramedics checked me out. I was handcuffed the entire time. Both impatient and dismissive of me, his attitude suggested that I had clearly done something to cause this." Months later, when my attorney showed me that video, I was both horrified and reassured that my memory was accurate. I felt so sorry for that woman calling for her mommy. There really was a large pool of blood in front of me. That day, I was put in an ambulance and the supervisor continued to interrogate me. One of the strangest parts of my experience was receiving medical care while being held captive, handcuffed. In the ambulance, I asked for the supervisor, "Why did this happen? Am I in custody?" I asked again, to use a phone. He switched the video off, practically spitting out the words. "These questions you are asking is why. Now I'm telling you what's going to happen. Be quiet. Lie down. You're going to county." And I'm going to stop there.
Wow. Testify, man. That's testimony. You are such a beautiful witness. I'm getting a little choked up because, you know, this happened to you, a woman, not a Black woman, you know, a Jewish woman. And it's just so powerful how you set it out, how it's surreal, how they don't care. I see this all the time. I've seen people eating their lunch in court while deputies take someone down to the ground. I've seen horrific things in court with deputies. Okay. I've been at the jail and watched how they treat people in custody and literally hosing a mentally ill woman down at Banning Jail one time in front of me while they're eating their popcorn. Not like they're not eating their popcorn like a movie. They're just eating their lunch and they can actually eat while doing these things or watching these things.
Yeah.
The fact that you were brutalized like that and that you were able to write about it, it's so important.
Well, I mean, it was really pretty horrific. And it was the thing that I always worried about happening to my Black son. And in fact, in that, in my memoir, there's one essay called Markers as My Black Son Got Older. And it's all the things that happened from when he was very young to as he grew up and became a taller young man. And the fears that I had and the hopes that I had. But yes, it was a pretty terrifying experience. And I have to say that.
And just so the audience knows, they settled with you. You were site released. You did nothing wrong. What they did was pretty much illegal the way they did it. They didn't have any reason to hurt you or take you into custody. They settled with you pretty quickly. You probably could have gotten more, but I'm really glad you got a settlement.
Yeah, that's correct. And after I went through this experience and my brother and I went to talk to civil rights attorneys and a friend of mine is the executive director of the LA County Commission on Human Relations. And I began to learn, there began to be also more articles about the culture of violence with the LA Sheriff's Department. Yeah. And the situation is that the sheriffs would be trained in jail. And there was this incredible culture of violence, like beating people when they were unconscious and saying, "Stop resisting."
Exactly.
Yeah. You know that because you were.
Because if they beat you up, they put a resisting charge against you. That's their trick because then you cannot sue them.
Exactly. That's what my friend said if they broke something or they beat you, that you're going to have charges. And after they learned this way of behaving in the jails, the sheriffs were then their first job out was on the metro. None of this did I know until afterwards. And I have to say that when I was in the process of editing my book, I had one author say to me, "Be careful when you go back in there. It's kind of a scary place," meaning when you go back into all the stuff of your past, that it can be traumatic. You know, and I thought that I had enough distance and I was writing the characters, you know, even though I was the character. But it was still... I think it was more traumatic than I realized. And one of the things I needed to do was remember some details because the supervisor who came videotaped me while I was being interrogated. And that actually turned out to be pretty damning for them and pretty helpful for me because you could actually see the pool of blood.
Yeah.
One of my earrings was floating around in it. And I was kind of stunned when I saw it. But when I had to go back and get the details, I had my partner watch the video. Like, I could not watch it again. And I remember when I went in to visit my attorney to get a copy of, because I had misplaced that, the video. It was originally published as a cover story for the Pasadena Weekly, but then it became a part of my memoir, and in fact became the title essay. And when I went in to see my former attorney, he was very excited because he had some really, as attorney, you could probably appreciate this, Jim. He had this really strong evidence. I don't know if you remember a young man, I think he was only 18, was brutally assaulted by Pasadena police in Altadena at a gas station. And he had like multiple pieces of evidence. And so he really wanted to show it to me. And it was just very traumatic, you know, both from my own experience and also my fears for my son.
And you know, what's interesting, when I was reading your memoir and I read that essay multiple times, and I've told you that we have a lot of intersections about three or four years ago, and I haven't written about it because I'm still a little traumatized about it. And nothing happened to your extent, but I got pulled over for running a red light in Riverside, the city I work as a public defender in. I told the police I had a condition that I needed to use the bathroom because I have a disability with holding my pee.
Got it.
It was pretty, you know, honest with them. Like, I have to pee and I can't hold it. And they said no. I literally pissed myself in my car while they took their time writing me a ticket that I actually didn't run the red light. I had to get out of my car because I was trying not to pee and I was going to like kind of dance around while they were writing the ticket. They pulled their guns on me.
Oh my God.
Riverside.
My God.
Police, not the sheriff, Riverside PD. If it had been the sheriff, I probably would have known them, or they would have known who I was. But these Riverside police had just been on a high speed chase. So they were all aggro, and it was a Latina and an African-American male. And I was like, how are you doing this to me? I work for the county. Are you effing stupid?
Unbelievable.
And I just started crying. The reason I bring this up, because I wasn't going to bring it up, because you went through 100 times worse than what I did.
Yeah, that's pretty terrible.
Even imagine. But I had video. I got the dash cam. And just watching it again, I was like horrified by their behavior towards me. And I kept on telling them, look, I'm a county employee. You can follow me to the bathroom. Like, I just got to take a piss. Like, and I had just been to lunch with like a county council. I was like, I literally just had lunch with the people who represent you, you idiots.
Right.
I mean, it's really, and I told them, if you treat me like this, how are you treating the general public? So that's why I say, like, they treated you like that, and you're a Jewish woman versus a young Black man. And I think is the station nearby where it's Fruitvale Station where the gentleman was killed, the African-American man.
Right. So
it's all a pattern. And they actually, what I've heard, they put the worst police at places like that because they have so many issues. So they'll put them at schools or they'll put them at the metro, you know? So that's what's really interesting. But that video that your lawyer got and you got, that must have been so damning.
It really was. And I also, you know, I wasn't, even though I was willing to testify if I had to, I wasn't that eager, because in another life I worked for the Seattle City Attorney's Office in a special program for domestic family violence cases. And I saw what happened to the women in the trials. I mean, basically the juries would decide, did they deserve to be beaten or not? It was pretty clear that I didn't want to go through that.
Well, I think it's really important too, that you use that story, and you put it in a newspaper and then you put it in your book. It becomes a form of witnessing, but it also becomes a form of amplifying your own voice for those who can't be heard. Right. And as a writer, you have all this legitimacy, but this happens every day.
What happens? You know, and I went to see my, you know, everybody's trying to figure out like, why did this happen? You know, and the logical explanation is what I talked to you about with the culture of violence. But a couple of interesting things that I heard over the years. I mean, I think one of the interviews I had, the interviewer said something about, I think that they have a view of anyone who rides public transportation, it's also a class thing, as being less than. And then my dentist looked at me when she was examining because I had a chip. I had some dental damage as well. And said, you look very Middle Eastern. I wonder if that's what, you know, was going on.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Right.
So who knows? But
it's also a culture of dehumanization that is prevalent at the sheriff and city attorney and the city police departments.
Yes.
For example, as a public defender, they'll say, oh, we're going to bring up the bodies. And I always say, you mean my clients? I used to not speak up before COVID. And after I wrote my book about social justice and being a public defender, I decided that I had to speak up when I heard these injustices. Yeah. Because what it does is it dehumanizes my clients. And then Absolutely. If they have to take them down and hurt them, they're just a body. And I'll say, please don't use the term bodies. I find it offensive.
That, yes, the dehumanization. I mean, it was really an eye opener for me to see, you know, like at some point I was told by one of the deputies, like, well, you'll have a phone and a TV, you know, like basically he was just giving me shit. Like, don't worry, once you go to jail, you'll have all these, you know, or when you're in the hospital. And I saw when I was there, because I was in pain for so long in an empty room with just a poster on the wall that said, you have a right to ask for pain medication. And I was crying. I saw how you could basically be disappeared, you know, and I begged the doctor who examined me and said, you know, you have a fractured nose and you'll have to deal with this later. But, you know, first of all, as you well know, the instructions they give you about whatever you're supposed to do if you go to jail are pretty much impossible to follow through with. But I also saw, you know, I asked him, I begged him, like, can you keep me here? I was at county hospital, you know, but in the locked part, you know, and he said, no, you know, if you stay here, you know, you're just going to be trapped. You know, it's not going to be any better, you know. So, yeah, I really felt like one could easily disappear and have very bad things happen to them without having any recourse. So.
Yeah, and I think people don't really realize that. And then everyone assumes you did something, right?
So oh, yeah. It's like
no one's going to step in because everyone assumes that the police have this police power and they're going to use it humanely, which they often don't. But the idea of disappearing, I think 18 people have died in the Riverside Jail just this year. Mm. And there's multiple lawsuits. And something happened personally to one of my clients.
Oh, my God.
It's horrifying because you can literally, when someone goes to jail and they're arrested, the police don't have to call anyone. They can hold you for 72 hours without even arraigning you. And then at arraignment, if they find out there's no evidence, they can release you at that point, or they can hold you for a prelim and then you have to post bail. Yeah. Imagine how much power that is.
Yeah, it's overwhelming. And that was, I think, something that I also wrote about and thought about is that strange dichotomy of being both a patient and a prisoner. And, you know, at some point I told them, you know, I need to check in on my son, you know, I need to find out whether my son is okay. That's all I could think of. And they're like, well, you haven't had to do that yet. Right. You know? So,
yeah.
I mean, it was very dehumanizing. And people did say after my, story was published, the cover story, you know, oh, you know, that makes me see that this could happen to anyone. I always assumed like these are mostly people who were white or middle class, you know, who believed that, yeah, that it would be a homeless or criminal, you know, like they couldn't see how you could be arrested or have this experience if you didn't, you know, you must have done something, you know. And I had a little bit of, not a lot, but a little bit of backlash when some weird comments after the cover story was published, you know. And I wrote a follow-up story called Bashing the Bashed that just talks about what happens when you speak out.
Well, what was brilliant about the way you structured your memoir, and I want to get into your poetry collection about a couple more questions, but the reason why I think that the One Day on the Gold Line essay just hits you over the head so much is that we know the narrator so well by this point. We have, you know, walked with her as she's trying to get pregnant, miscarrying, having a son, And relationships and drama and economic struggles and wanting to be a writer and that journey. And so I think that's why you could have put it at the beginning, right? But mm-hmm. I think putting it where you put it, it was perfect. And I talk a lot about how all my favorite albums are sequenced perfectly. If you look at Ziggy Stardust by Bowie, 5 years is the first song, right? And it's about this alien talking about the end of the world, like an otherworldly alien talking about the end of the world. And it sets that tone. And so you putting this kind of in the middle, mm-hmm. it was brilliant because everything that became before that set us up to know this narrator so well that we were just so horrified and we've just felt for her so much. And then the second half has more resonance.
Yeah, because I think it's also about, you know, I thought I had hit bottom at that point, you know, and you know, it's about resilience too. And like kind mm-hmm. of finding what it is that I can go back to. It's not all in chronological order, but it does have a progression. And, you know, I thought that that was pretty much the worst thing that could happen at that point. But then I came face to face with multiple occasions where my son almost died. From overdoses on drugs. So, you know, I discovered, no, that's the real, I mean, the thing that as a mother, you know, I was never one of those mothers that could say I could go on if my son died, you know, to this day, I can't say what would happen. I can't imagine, like, we shouldn't even have that conversation.
I'm so proud that he came so far. It was like, almost like how to get, like how to triumph over addiction and working on your sobriety. And it's never over, right? I'm not sober. And I struggle with, you know, alcohol and stuff. And I tell people, I still smoke cigarettes and I'm 52 years old. I started smoking when I was 12. And that's so incredible. I am not perfect at all. I have a sister in sobriety, my twin. And I work, I encourage my clients to be sober because the sobriety with the severe mental health, schizophrenia and bipolar doesn't really work if they're drinking and using substances. But, you know, weed is legal. I love that for pain management. It's a lot better than a pill. But talk about writing about your son. Was he okay with it? Talk about writing about family in general. We have a lot of these writers who listen for craft kind of content. How would you suggest people go about this? Did you ask permission? Everyone does it different, you know?
Right. So I definitely asked for permission. My son was extremely encouraging at the time that I was working on the memoir. Yeah.
Both, right.
I think that those words are related. Yeah. When I was working on the memoir, he was very, you know, very much about, you know, maybe this will help other people write the story. I did ask him to read it, like after it was accepted by a publisher, I gave him a copy and said, please read it. There might be some chapters that might be a little uncomfortable. You know, there's some with sexual content. Nobody wants to read about their mom and sexual content. could skip that. But he never read it in full. He's heard parts of it. And, you know, I have mixed feelings as he gets older. Like there are times where I think, you know, was that okay? Even though he continues to give me permission. So much of my poetry has to do with motherhood and I write about mm-hmm. him and it's very, he's very much a part of my writing still. And he really encouraged me to keep writing. I asked him, do you want to see these poems before I send them out to be published? And he told me, no, just write them. I don't need to see them.
Yeah. And I know Annie Lamott writes about her son, Sam, a lot, and she kind of deals with the same issue. There's the two memoirs about addiction, Beautiful Boy and Tweak, that go together.
Yes. I reference them in my book.
Mm-hmm. I do want to move to your poetry collection, Secondary Inspections, that was published most recently by Nymeria Publishing. And it's such a beautiful collection. Talk about how you write in different genres, whether genre matters to you. I had this discussion with my friend Samuel Ottman recently, who's a professor at DePaul, who's one of my good friends that I met at Bona. Excuse me. And I was talking about, does genre matter anymore? Does what you call a piece matter because of autofiction and all the blurred lines? I do a lot of hybrid work where I put poetry in with memoir. Talk about that issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think hybrid work is wonderful. And I have to say, I'm a multi-genre writer. I started out in nonfiction, primarily like memoir and personal essay, some journalistic pieces. And then at some point, I started writing poetry. I was pushed by this poet, Gerda Govini Tuarte, who kept telling me, you are a poet and I want you to be part of this Pasadena Rose Poets. And I kept saying, no, I'm primarily not a poet. I only write a few poems every couple of years. But something about that push is I started to write a lot in short form. And a lot of my poetry, but my poetry tends to run long. And so you'll see an intersection between memoir or nonfiction and poetry, where it's almost like micro memoir. It's somewhere like some people might call this micro memoir. In my poetry collection, there are some pieces that are a little closer to micro memoir, some pieces that are very prosy. And I mean, most of my poetry is pretty narrative.
I love how you put words together. I was rereading it late last night and I said aloud, she makes me want to write more poetry. And I, like you, has always said, I'm not a poet. I'm a memoirist. I'm a prosist. I'm a prose person. But, I had all this old poetry that I pulled together from my, to put with Tales of an Inland Empire Girl, because I thought it kind of fit at the end.
That was great. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it has a different feel, you know. But the way that you put words together, like you're almost like, I would say, a memoirist favorite kind of poet, because you string these ideas together and we get the whole kind of portrait.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I've had to work. I've had to kind of have a crash course in poetry, poetic techniques over the years, and have studied with some really wonderful poets. I appreciate what you say about that. I was going to say something about fiction as well, that at a certain point I got tired of, after my memoir, I was tired of writing in a mother's voice. And so I started writing one of the young men who was in the recovery house with my son, who was just a beautiful, beautiful person, Elijah, went back out at some point, got into some kind of altercation, and he was just the gentlest soul. Like, you can't imagine him doing anything aggressive or violent, but he got into this altercation out on the street when he was using it, and he got sent to prison. And then he got out and at some point overdosed and died. And I was just so sad, you know, so heartbroken, first just of what being in prison would do to this gentle soul. And so I took a character, I started writing this fiction about a family, a two-mother family, a blended family, a family with adopted kids as well as birth child, multiracial and imperfect, but still intact. And I primarily started out writing from the voice of starting at 15 years old, this young man was not the addict in the family. So it was really refreshing to write. There was a character who struggled with addiction, but it was a sister. It was really refreshing to write in a different voice. And in these linked short stories, I write in multiple voices and finally circled back to some of the moms, the birth mom and one of the adoptive moms. But it was such a nice escape from nonfiction. And I just pulled out all that work and I'm going to go back to it.
It's hard though, as a memoirist, as someone who starts out in nonfiction like me, I'm working on a young adult novel called Runaway, and it's not me, but she's kind of based on me in an alternate universe. If I'd ran away from home when I was like 16 to New York, where I, and this little narrator thinks that the punk scene is still active in New York, and it's not. Everyone's dead, you know? And she takes her little sister with her. Instead of three sisters, it's two. But I'm having a really hard time with the imagination and letting go. And what do you suggest for the writers who are listening when you're transitioning from nonfiction to fiction to allow yourself that freedom and that beauty and the liberty to do whatever you want?
Well, I have to think about that because I'm trying to go back to it now and fill in some of the pieces. I have a lot of like short stories. And one of the things that I did that got me into it initially is I didn't write about Elijah, the young man who died, but I wrote about, but I took his gentle spirit and I inserted his spirit into my male character who, as I said, was not an addict, but he had the ternura. He had the sweetness, the manner of Elijah. And at the time when I was doing this, I started out writing fiction in my MFA program, and it really helped to have prompts.
Okay.
I definitely think that having prompts, like a lot of times there's prompts that you could write. Like sometimes I'll write like a poem, a nonfiction, and a fiction piece to it, you know, and see how differently they come out. But
that's a great idea.
Yeah. But I think you really have to, like, I really to inhabit the, you know, I showed one of my story. I had my brother-in-law read one of my stories because I had to write a sex scene. This 15-year-old met a 23, looked like he was 23 because he was a big young man. He was Samoan and Tlingit, Alaskan native. And this 23-year-old mistook him for also being a college student. Ah. And he didn't completely, he said he was in his senior year of high school. My first time I wrote the short story, I wrote it with him running away from the situation. Like, this is too weird, you know? And then I was told I think I was still in a class, you know, like, now go back and rewrite it with him not running away.
Oh.
You know, and then eventually I workshopped the piece and I was told, now you have to write about the first, because that was the first time he had sex. And that was really challenging, you know, writing a sex scene from the perspective of a 15-year-old.
Yeah, male, right? So, yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know if I'm exactly answering your question, but it's like you have to have fun with it. I mean, like, okay. Like go wild, kind of really. And it's not bad to like draw from your real life. It doesn't have to be what I guess they're calling auto fiction. Like, it doesn't have to be a carbon. Like mix it up. Like, draw a characteristic, draw a situation. Piece that was part of the link short stories based on a real life incident where I live in Northwest Pasadena and someone came to my I heard this pounding on my door and there were these two very tall white police women and they told me like, and they start yelling at me when I open the door saying, is there a black woman in the house? And it was just this like, what the, you know? And then they told me to step out and, you know, and then wow. When I said, no, not today, but they ran off without an explanation. And it was so disturbing to me that I ended up writing it as a short story.
Oh, how interesting. And, you know, another thing you said a little earlier when we were talking about your transition to poetry is that someone pushed you to be a poet and that you took these craft classes and you worked on that. And I know exactly what you mean, like that that inner saboteur where I always say, I'm not good enough. I'm not a good poet. I don't know the line breaks. And so I've taken a couple poetry classes. But it really takes someone who's already a poet to tell you that you have a poetic voice. For me, it was Stephanie Barbie Hammer. I took a pandemic. She's the reason I got my first book deal is she, you know, told me, oh, I think you'd be a good fit. Your public defender poetry and maybe some memoir stuff would be a good fit for Bamboo Dart Press. They're putting out these little chapbooks. And she really loved my poetry. And she's like, your poetry, it's like almost like spoken word, like you're supposed to read it aloud. When I hear you read it, it's totally different. Right. So she gave me the confidence. And I did not have a great time in that class. I had a good time with Stephanie, but there was one student who was a very well-known, amazing poet that just was not denigrating, but just saw the flaws and didn't really see the good stuff. Mm. And I'm glad she commented on my line breaks and stuff. I needed the kind of, but I wasn't confident enough to take criticism at that point, you know?
Yeah, and also, you know, having taught workshop, you know, you really need to start out calling out what resonates in a positive, you know, in the, like, there's a way to workshop, you know, and I can't tell you how many students I get who tell me that they, like, when I teach college level, that they were like crushed by what some high school teacher said to them. But I was just going to add that I did also start writing shorter form during the pandemic. That's when I really found like, what the heck has happened to me? I can only write poetry now in short form. You know, there was something about the pandemic that put me in that place. And I've sort of been stuck in that for like, it's not so much stuck, but I embraced it. I said, okay, so I'm a poet. I'm going to, you know, like, you know, maybe.
Hallelujah. I mean, you're the co-poet laureate of Altadena. Talk about that. How did that happen? That is just amazing, the kind of community interaction you get to do in that role. Do you want to tell the listeners really quick about how that occurred and what you do in that role as the co-poet laureate of Altadena? Which Altadena, for those listening in, is a city in the San Gabriel Valley that is pretty much north of
Pasadena.
By Pasadena.
Right up against it. Well, I was asked by the poet laureates from the year before to apply, and I did, and was selected along with my co-poet laureate, Peter J. Harris. And, you know, we had a really ambitious schedule of workshops and readings, and it was great. We wanted to kind of raise the ante, like have people come to expect to have regular programming and bring in, there's just some really stellar poets in this area, in the greater LA area. We wanted to really, you know, bring in both people who didn't consider themselves poets and people who were poets to participate, you know, and mix that. And I had this, Peter had this idea of Ode to the Land, of writing about land and place and identity. And I had this idea of bringing together elders 55 and up and young people, like an intergenerational writing experience. And so when we applied for and received the Academy of American Poets Poet Laureate Fellowship, we were able to fund that project. We just had one of our readings at the Zorthian Ranch, of this iconic property in this area, with one of your guests, Xochihilusa Bermejo.
I love her.
And it was a beautiful experience. And we did have people, young people and older people, get published for the first time in our anthology, which is coming out on April 27th is going to be our release. We have a big poetry and cookies party.
Where's that at?
That is at the Altadena Main Library. And it's from 11 to 1 on Saturday. So it's been really busy for the last 2 years. We're coming to a close at the end of April. We have new poet laureates coming in. And, you know, you're kind of like an ambassador for poetry to the community, you know, bringing people in who maybe consider themselves not to like poetry or to not be poets, as well as people who love poetry, and being available to interact with the community on everything related to poetry, and to just bring this programming, rich programming in so that people can really soak up what a poem means. And, you know, let's face it, right? Poetry is kind of a conversation already, you know, because you write a poem and you have some intention and thought behind it, but then the reader takes their own life into it when they read it and comes up with a whole different poem in a way, in how they perceive the poem.
And what's so interesting, you say that one of the themes was the intergenerational, but also Ode to the Land. You know, I have this, I write a lot about home and place, and I have this theory. I mean, my book is called Tales of an Inland Empire Girl, and I always knew Inland Empire would be in the title. I went through different iterations, but I finally based it on Judy Bloom's, you know, one of Judy Bloom's books. Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, Tales
yes,
of
a Yes.
And what I love about your work is it's so steeped in being California. It's so steeped in that. You're definitely like a California writer in the best kind of way. And I have this theory that if you write about a place that has resonance to you, or about a person that's in a place that has resonance to you, the story will come out on its own. It's almost like the ancestors are whispering in your ear. And I've had this happen to me when I've written about certain places, my grandpa's house. One of the things I love so much about your poetry is that you always steep it in place. California, you also have a story about Seattle, a poem about Seattle.
Yeah, that's right from originally.
Yeah, but all you, yeah. So even though, but I mean, North, I guess you'd say the Pacific Northwest, you're like right. this, you're just, and you talk a lot about, you know, Pasadena, and there's one about a Trader Joe's. Where was that Trader Joe's at?
Yeah, that was one of the persona. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I really love that about it. There's another writer, Jose Hernandez Diaz, that does similarly, yes. Where he kind of steeps his poems in LA, or, you know, I think he's from, he's not technically from LA. He's like from Torrance, but from that area, you know, cause this thing about Southern California, right? The 10 freeway, all these different freeways that kind of merge together. Right. And you have all these poets from these different boroughs kind of like, you know, Torrance or LA or the Inland Empire, and the Inland Empire is huge, right? Riverside, San Bernardino, all the way to the desert, to Blythe, right? Tisha Reichle Aguilera just wrote a book, and her, she was raised in Blythe, which is the end of the Inland Empire. Oh, you got to get Breaking Pattern. It's
so good. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, I'd never read a story about a Chicana cowgirl from Riverside before. And I know many of them, and being a kind of a cowgirl myself, growing up steeped in country music with a white father who owned a bar in Ontario. A honky tonk in a Mexican neighborhood. And I identified with her story so well. And I just got a new pair of cowboy boots from my sister in Kansas City. I love the cowboy
boots.
Yeah, the cowboy look, culture. And it's so related to Mexico, you know, with the norteñas, with all this stuff, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So let's talk about that really quick. I do want you to read from your poetry collection. Right. We have another 10, 15 minutes or so, and then I want you to tell people where to find you. But first, let's talk about, you did work in Mexico, right? You worked in almost like a social justice
work. I was going to school. I did a year abroad, and at the time, I really wanted to study political economy, essentially Marxist economics, and was very interested in social justice work. And I found myself, I found out about this organization that was started by a coalition of feminist groups, including and people like Marta Lamas, who was, I think, the editor of Femme, the wonderful feminist magazine that was, I don't know if it's still being put out, but in Mexico. We're talking about the early 1980s right now. And so I found out about this organization, Centro de Apoyo para Mujeres Violadas, and it was basically set up to bring women into political struggle and political action work, but by offering concrete support around the issue of sexual assault. And because at the time, they weren't having a lot of success with like prosecutions and success in the criminal justice system.
Because of the corruption in Mexico, or?
And also just because of some of the same reasons, like I had people say, oh, that must be a huge problem in Mexico, rape. And I was like, no, actually, it's a very huge problem in the United States, around the world. It's pretty universal. And so it was also just the attitudes about, you know, still like sexual assault and being about how women dress. I remember this one prosecutor was interviewed, was like, well, you know, they dress in their short skirts in the springtime. And so we
have nothing to do with it. Rape's about power, right? It's not really.
So it was educating about exactly the power. And then we would take action. So for example, there was a young woman in one of these vecindad, in these areas where there's a lot of little apartments together and everybody knows each other. And this young woman was an incest victim. And the kids in the neighborhood, the boys were saying, well, let me be the next one. And so a group of women from this organization went in and did a theater production which educated people about sexual assault and fantastic. Really sort of changed the dynamic. And there were a lot of very creative actions like that. So I was studying a year abroad, but then I ended up staying like an extra year and almost was going to graduate from the UNAM, where I was studying economics. And I did my thesis when I graduated from UC Santa Cruz. My thesis was around this organization and some of their growing pains.
Fantastic. You're such a Renaissance woman. I mean, honestly, you've done so much in your life. I just have to say my favorite poem in your collection. I mean, it's all tabbed up. You can see it. The readers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But I love that poem. I am a woman of almost 62.
I was going to read that today. Yeah.
I was going to ask you to, you know, I just turned 52 and I have my best friend, Melinda. Sorry for calling you out here. Never likes to say her age. And I own my age because I'm like, I'm 52 and I like myself more. I'm bigger than I was when I was young. I'm fuller. I'm bigger in so many ways, both literally and figuratively. And I just love myself. And I look at old pictures of myself and I just see this really insecure girl that just wanted to be thin or wanted to be liked or wanted to be. I identify with this poem.
Yeah. I mean, I'm 65. I published my first book when I was 60.
Wow.
I've been on a couple, this is going to be my second panel about it was on a panel of writers about memoir who published their first memoir over 60. And now I'm going to be on lesbian writers over six poets over 60. So I'm afraid I'm going to become the voice of writers over 60, but.
Frank McCourt published Andrew's Ashes when he was 60 something, his That's first amazing. Book, That's won the Pulitzer Prize. And why? Because he lived his whole life doing other things. He was a teacher. He, you know, immigrated from Ireland. And I'm obsessed with Irish writers in general. But when we went to his house in Limerick, and where he grew up, and there's an old man there who hates him. But I would just remember, like, this man took all that experience from when he was young and waited 60 years to write about it, and then wins the Pulitzer.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's a great story. I wish I could tell that same story, but
I
didn't win.
Well, I wrote my first book at 49. I had already written my memoir. That got published later at 50. And I always said, I don't think but for COVID, I would have ever published my, I would have never, I had been looking for an agent, a publisher for years. And something about COVID told me, if you don't put tales out there, you're going to die with it in that drawer. And it's not perfect. It's not a perfect book. It's a little scattered and I would do it differently today, but I still love that I got it out there. I'm just so proud of myself.
Yeah, you know? I totally hear you. I felt the same way. I felt the sense of urgency. It was prior to COVID, but I was getting close to 60. And I just felt this urgency. Like, I definitely had a different feeling about getting it published. The people from my MFA program told me, you know, you need to get an agent. And I started to send it out to agents and got feedback from two that, you know, some really great feedback, but didn't take it. They say you should send it out to 100 agents before you give it. But I got really impatient. Yeah. I started sending it to independent publishers and ultimately went with that because I started to feel like the same thing you said. Like, you know, I got to publish this before I forget, you know, before I can't remember my story.
No, and I'm so glad you went with the small press, you know, independent press. So did I. And I love my press and I have my rights back so I could go with a different press, but I'm not going to. Frank at Los Nietos is great. He's also publishing Liz Gonzalez's most recent book that's coming out soon about the Lady of Guadalupe Church in San Bernardino. Give Liz a shout out. I love you, Liz. So can you, before we get into your final reading, and I could talk to you for hours, so you might have to come back on next season.
I'd love to.
Tell people where they can find you. And you already said about one event at, that's on April 27th. Remind people where that's at and how to find you and your website and your work. And then if you could read from your beautiful collection of poetry, Secondary Inspections, you can get that everywhere, but it's by Nymeria Publishing.
Okay, so my website is really simple. It's carlasameth.com. S-A-M, Carla with a C, Sameth, S-A-M-E-T-H.com. And what else did you want? Okay, and our event, it's our final event of our laureateship. And it will also be when people who are featured in the anthology will read. It's called Poetry and Cookies. It's on April 27th from Saturday from 11 to 1. And it's at the Altadena Main Library in Altadena. And please come.
Yay.
Yeah. Was there anything else I was supposed to include?
No. Just if you want to read now and then stick around after your reading, we'll say our goodbyes and then stick around for a second because I got to get you a Life of Gem cup.
Oh, I need that. I was looking at it right then.
Oh, you'll get the good one that says the podcast Writers on Writing. This is the old one that was from my blog. But I just wanted to tell everyone listening in, if you want to win a copy of either of Carla's books, please just share this podcast or write a review or post it on your page, however you want to do that. And then let me know you did that via email, gemmantz@yahoo.com, gemmantz@yahoo.com. And I will put you in a drawing for a copy of the book. And actually the first person that does it is going to win a copy of Secondary Inspections because I have another copy right here to send out. And then I'll put the rest of the people in a drawing for the memoir. I have another copy, One Day on the Gold Line, a memoir and essays.
Thank you.
So take it away. I'm going to mute myself.
Okay. I'm going to start. Does anyone in Southern California remember 2020 in the fall and the fires? So I have a chapbook that's all poems written during the pandemic. The murder of George Floyd, everything that happened during that period of time from March, had to think for a moment, March 2020 to August 2020. And some of those poems made it into this book as well. But this poem is about fall of 2020. Love Letter to a Burning World, Southern California, 2020. Praise the dark that covers us with ashes, this morning's tears, reminding us why we cherish the not burning baby cry of awake. Not heartbreak. Mom, I need a hug, please. I just can't seem to do anything right. Raphael, the angel name. Should we have birthed a warrior instead? One who could fight the demons? I can't say for sure I'm an addict, but I'm doing too much. He gets up, then decides he'd rather smoke. Not feeling okay right now. I am twisted up. Feel the same way. Not okay. No, son, what you are feeling are singed embers after 6 months of shutdown, broken glass, murder after murder of men and women the color of your skin, at traffic stops, in the dark, in bed, while jogging, anywhere. Praise the path that brought you here today, a boomerang. Mom, I can't make it. I'm at the car repair. I need to keep looking for someone who can fix this. The drop, like we hear in music, I hear it in his soul. My face is wet as he leaves in a gust. I have to meet my friends at the demonstration. I'll feel better, more purpose. Do you kill a child by holding or letting go? Ashes, ashes, as he runs out the door. Doesn't he know this is an emergency? Like the blare of fire warning. Pack your bags comes from the evacuation order. Today, his voice searing into my chest. Praise his tears for crying with me. Praise the seat that holds me fast.
Beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm going to say that I've had interesting discussions with my sisters about my work, and I'm sure that any of you who have family members alive, siblings, will say that we all have different memories based on our birth order, just based on our memory. And my sisters have been kind enough. In particular, I've talked to my older sister a lot about this, where sometimes she's not comfortable with me writing about family stories. I have a poem in here, The Family Stories, which I'm not going to read, but if you buy the book, you can read it. And sometimes we claim the same stories and argue about whose story was it. And yet, even though she's not always comfortable with what I write, she has always told me, it's your writing. Tell your story. I support you, even if it makes me uncomfortable. And for that, I really love and appreciate her, my sisters. We used to argue over hearts. I called my older sister over and over again whenever I ran away. The first time, six, crossing the street to the little park. But then I couldn't come back because I'd remember I wasn't allowed to cross the street by myself. I sat on a pile of leaves, sniffling, imagining my sister rescuing me. When I was a teenager, she went away to college. I'd telephone her, my complaints a steady pitter-patter or a torrent, depending on the temperature at home. My brother taught me how to avoid recurring nightmares by focusing on the scariest moments before going to sleep. I was terrorized by dreams about Bunny Goo, who was either a tall, bald white man who wanted to take over the world, or a sticky tar that got on the bathtub faucet and caused it to overflow. My younger sister gave me imaginary sleeping pills, told me to just breathe and think about ocean waves and Mount Rainier, ferry boats and sunsets over Puget Sound. She teaches meditation now. We were so young then, turning to the closet for refuge. My dad was a high school teacher who used to say, with liberty and justice for some, when forced to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. He was my favorite dance partner, and I felt graceful on the floor with him at weddings and bar mitzvahs. My mom went out for Shirley Chisholm. She worked, went to school, and took care of the four of us plus my dad. Later, with almost all speech robbed by dementia, she found the words, "God, that man is repulsive," when pre-2016 Trump was on television. I miss my mom and dad, even the fights and the television blaring news, my dad's temper, his humor, his kindness. Our stuffed animals, large, wise, and plush, sat sentry while we ran amok. Eat a thigh instead. Dark meat is juicier. We used to argue over the hearts and gizzards. Now no one wants those parts. Thank you. And if I can find it.
I love that poem. I had marked that one too.
Oh, good. Well, I'm a few years older than what this title says now, but nonetheless. I am a woman of almost 62 years old, of no special bravery. Every day I wake up to my wife clutching me tightly, then singing loudly, and the cat, once a teen mama, pounding on the door, last night's gunshots not yet forgotten. Turn up the sound, I say, that song about waking up and working hard each day, though I am a woman inert until I decide to throw off all the weighted memories, falling down interiors, the magic elastic that holds my unkind body tight to my imagination, until I step out and blow kisses to the hummingbird, frantic, ecstatic, or just doing its job, circling the bird of paradise. 2 years older than I was when my son, friends, and family threw that party for me, the trio playing songs I'd once danced to, baby in sling like piel canela, the carne, the aguas, las flores, pastel de las tres leches. My friend Gary showed up, only to jump from a parking structure weeks later. He'd told me it's been a rough year, and I agreed, it's been a year. And he said, we'll talk. But we never did, not really. He only called me to tell me how proud he was of me, my son, all we've done. And damn him, he didn't wait for that conversation about the obliterating fog, the deep downward slide, the gray as if he were another Seattle child, or whatever said to him, jump, Gary, jump. I am a woman almost 62 who once had moxie, chopped wood, built trails, leaped in front of skinheads who threatened me and my two sisters, a tiny speck lost in a corner, wondering if I'll rise up and blow out to the sky when we can finally open the doors. 62, but still the nail that may not bend, the mango sweet and spicy, chili and limon that bring a mouth alive, the lips that remember the softest kisses billowing across continents, only to discover they were once here, right beside me. The skater leaping, flying, shimmying, a fountain of joy. And since I'm not gliding, my son is sliding through Venice Beach and home again to me. I am the arms that held him, milky sweet sweat that opened up skyward to the honeyed moon and the bright, bright stars. Thank you.
Oh, I love that poem so much. It's like your song of yourself, you know? Beautifully done.
Thank you.
Well, we have to go, everyone, but I want to thank everyone for listening. Go out and get Carla Samet's work, please. Samet's work, Secondary Inspections, One Day on the Gold Line, and others. Check out her website. And our last guest for this season will be James Ducat. He's a professor at Riverside Community College, and he just came out with a chapbook. So he'll be on. He'll be my last guest of this season. Then we'll be taking a break and we will restart up in fall of 2024. So thank you, Carla. It's been such an illuminating and invigorating conversation. I so appreciate you coming on and reading your beautiful work.
Oh my God, Jem, thank you so much for this conversation. I love talking to you. You're wonderful. I love your energy and everything you have to say and your writing.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
We need to do a reading together one day. We got to put something together. I would love to read with you.
Let's do that.
Okay.
Let's do that.
Let's do it. Okay. Bye, everyone. Have a great day. Bye, and remember, check us out on Apple Podcasts. Write a review or share this and you can win a copy of Carla's book. Bye, everyone. Bye.
Bye.